Thank you, Robert. And I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation to speak. And I hope that this somewhat rambling and expository talk will will prove to be of some interest to the audience. I'm reminded actually of a joke in giving this talk. It's the one about the sociology professor. He's sitting in his office and his teaching assistant runs in and he says, Professor, this final exam that you've written, it's exactly the same as the one you gave in the course 2 years ago. And the professor says, that's okay, don't worry. The questions are the same, but the answers are all different. So in fact, the questions that I'm going to be talking about are indeed the same questions that one could have asked not 2 years ago, but 15 or 20 years ago. And in fact, were asked in the context of field theory long before any of us started thinking seriously about string theory. And I guess that the best that one can say about them is that having new backgrounds and the dualities between these and the old ones shed some light and perhaps give you some computational tools to address questions which, you know, were hard then and, to be honest, are still hard now. But at least you can look at them and maybe hope to say something new. So why would mathematicians be interested in this? Well, I think the real reason is that all of these dualities seem to lead to interesting mathematical consequences. Okay, and in fact, the less supersymmetry, the more interesting the consequences are. So last week we heard a series of lectures from Emmanuel Diaconescu, and this morning from Sheldon about Gromov-Witten invariants. Okay, and so closed string have to do with what we call n equals 2 supersymmetry, 8 real superchargers. And the open string Gromov-Witten invariants, which are much more subtle and considerably more interesting to look at, have to do with n equals 1 or 4 real superchargers. Okay? And so the less supersymmetry is just one example and will not play any further role in my talk. But it's an example of how things get much more interesting and intricate in the less supersymmetry you have. And so the dualities involved are, here you have mirror symmetry, here you have these large end dualities between closed and open amplitudes, and so the dualities are rather more intricate and elaborate. So physicists are interested in this subject also because they're hoping someday to reproduce the standard model describing particle physics in the real world. And the real world is four-dimensional, and there really isn't any unbroken supersymmetry in the real world. But as I'll argue in a couple of minutes, n equals 1 is a sort of useful way station along the way. We're interested in having some particular gauge group emerge in four dimensions, and then with quarks and leptons and Higgses, and maybe, in fact, there might even be three generations of chiral multiplets, you know, corresponding to the quarks and leptons that we know about. And the cosmological constant should be rather small, maybe positive, but at least small. And, you know, the proton shouldn't decay before we get to talk about it. And, you know, the quark and lepton masses should work. I mean, there's lots and lots of stuff that one has to do, more than I could even summarize, let alone try to unsuccessfully explain how string theory might produce all of those facts. So let me explain why n equals 1 is sort of a useful way station. And the reason is if supersymmetry breaking effects are weak relative to the Planck scale. So they can't be too weak, otherwise we would have seen the super partners of the particles that we know and love already. But, you know, people big accelerators in the hope that we might see them, you know, within the next decade. Okay, so that, and if that hope is to be realized, then these supersymmetry breaking effects can't be that large either. So the typical sort of story that people looking for funding to build accelerators might tell you is, well, first of all, the Planck scale, let me write that. But the supersymmetry mass splittings might be, you know, 16 orders of magnitude smaller. Okay, such a huge hierarchy, unpalatably huge. If there's what in the jargon gets called a hidden sector, in which supersymmetry breaking is rather larger. So there's, say, in the range of maybe 10 to the 13th or 10 to the 14th Jev. And then the mass splittings, what we observe, would be given by this sort of seesaw type mechanism and be, you know, palatably small and maybe to be seen at the LHC, where the fundamental scale is still pretty far from, pretty small compared to the Planck scale, but not outrageously far. Okay, and perhaps intelligibly, that ratio might be intelligible. So either way, if anything written on this part of the blackboard is true, there's a long range of energies in which the real four-dimensional world looks approximately supersymmetric. And so it's a good place to start one's considerations, even though one eventually has to get down to effects, you know, of this order. After all, quark and lepton masses and everything we know and care about real physics are all effects, at least, I mean, below a TeV. That's all of the physics that we actually observe. So, these effects are comparable, indeed, responsible for everything that we see. So, in recent years, there's a sort of prevailing viewpoint, in recent years, maybe the past one or two, a prevailing viewpoint about how we get from string theory to something that might look like this, okay? And this is what's called a three-step program, okay? So step number one is to consider compactifications to four-dimensional Minkowski space with unbroken n equals 1 supersymmetry, okay? Perhaps it's the heterotic string on a Calabi-Yau manifold, or M-theory on a manifold of G2 holonomy, or type 2 orientifolds, or some French background, okay? These are very interesting, but typically, such solutions occur in families. And what that means for physicists is that there are massless scalars which are part of chiral multiplets in four dimensions. So these are, if you want to think about it, there's a sort of nonlinear sigma model whose target space is the moduli space of this family, okay? And then these scalars are long wavelength fluctuations in that nonlinear sigma model, okay? And that's actually sort of an observational disaster. I mean, we don't have such massless scalars. And so step two of the program is to turn on fluxes, which generate a scalar, a potential . So I should have said this target space, this moduli space, is a Kähler manifold, okay? And the there's a superpotential W which is a holomorphic section of a certain line bundle over this moduli space, and K is the so this line bundle is equipped with a fiber metric, which is related to this e to the k, and so this is the covariant derivative. The correspond the metric compatible connection, and this equation over here, you know, the Kähler potential, you can shift it by the sum of a holomorphic and an anti-holomorphic piece, and that corresponds to rescaling W. So K goes to K plus and W goes to 1 over F times W is an invariance of this scalar potential, right? That's the way it's arranged. And so the point is this thing, if you're lucky, has isolated minima, and you have supersymmetry is preserved if you have the covariant, the Kähler covariant derivative of W equal to zero, And then and typically at such a minimum, W is not zero. So we're sort of looking at solutions to this W non-zero. We look at solutions to this pair, and there what you'll find is a vacuum energy, typically negative, okay, given by this term over here, because W is non-vanishing, even though this term is vanishing. So I'll call this lambda flux, which is V at and if one arranges things suitably, the four-dimensional anti-de Sitter space that you obtain is large compared to the four-dimensional Planck scale, and so it's reasonable to study, you know, field theory, supergravity in such a space. So at step two of our three-step program, we end up in some large four-dimensional anti-de Sitter space with none of these massless scalars. So all these guys have gained masses through this potential. But with unbroken supersymmetry still. And then in step three, the idea is that one should finally include the effect of supersymmetry breaking through some more or less, usually less, understood mechanism. Yes? Oh, so the fact that V isn't zero at the minimum, okay, means that there's a cosmological constant, there's some vacuum energy, okay? And from the formula there, you see it's negative, okay? And so it's the solution to Einstein's equations with negative cosmological constant, okay? All right, is anti-de Sitter space. Is an anti-de Sitter. The four-dimensional metric is an anti-de Sitter metric. Right. And now this starts to become more, if you know, everything I've set up till now was rock solid, now we start to get a little bit fanciful. Okay. When you break supersymmetry, you typically get some positive contribution. To the vacuum energy, and so that the original one plus this thing that you've added, okay, is approximately zero and maybe slightly positive. I harp on that only because that's what astronomers tell me it should be. And you know, I don't know enough not to trust them. Okay. So I want to actually make a remark now, which is maybe of more interest to the physicists who thought about this cosmological constant a bit. And the remark is that the usual question one asks about the cosmological constant which is why is the cosmological constant much, much less than the supersymmetry breaking scale, or even if we take sort of the most optimistic version, like that's the weak scale. Okay? And this is actually the wrong, because what you expect is the supersymmetry breaking effects, which produce mass splittings, should also produce contributions to the vacuum energy of a comparable size. Right? And so here we see the vacuum energy is small, but the mass splittings are large. Right? Why is that? Okay? This is the wrong question. You see, what happens is that the corrections to the vacuum energy are large. Okay? It's just you start with something negative. Okay? So the corrections what's small is the sum of the contribution of this supersymmetry breaking to the vacuum energy and the vacuum energy that you started with. There's still a fine tuning, but the point is you need to think about that rather than the previous question. Okay.
The thing in the bar in the is lambda true.
Yes.
So those questions are isomorphic.
As mathematicians will tell you, isomorphic does not mean equal. You see, that's a somewhat flip answer, but in fact, one of the things that one's mindset gets into when you think about the question the first way is that somehow zero seems like a more natural point than small and positive. Okay, here you see there's no distinction, right? Really, the point is you have these two things that almost precisely cancel, and whether they almost precisely cancel, leaving you something precisely zero or slightly large or slightly small.
So string theory predicts that it's non-zero, but like most of the string theory, it was created after the observation.
Oh, absolutely. This is all post hoc. Yeah, no, nothing. Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah, yeah. Oh. That's a beautiful question. I mean, we should not be thinking about this as a process that happens in over the course of time. This is, pedagogically set out. One thing you might say, at step two, why don't I use my newfound knowledge of the ADS-CFT correspondence to describe string theory at step two in terms of the dual field theory on the boundary, right? And then Greg's question comes back and forth, what does supersymmetry breaking, which puts you ultimately in de Sitter space, look like from the point of view of the dual field theory to ADS4? I'll leave that as something to work on while the rest of the talk goes on. I have no answer to that question, but that is a version of your question. So I will mostly talk about step one, have a little bit to say about step two, and except for the remarks that I'm hastily erasing, nothing at all to say about step three. Okay? So there are various ways. Let's see, did I skip something here? No. There are various ways of achieving step one. One which I'll kind of try to dwell on a bit more because it's somewhat more novel, is to take M theory compactified on a 7 manifold of G2 holonomy, and I put manifold in quotes because it has various sorts of singularities that one needs to prescribe. And there are various dual situations. So one is if we take a Calabi-Yau manifold M with an anti-holomorphic involution, tau. So tau star, the pullback of the holomorphic 3 form is its complex conjugate, and the pullback of the Kähler form is minus the Kähler form, then you can put a G2 structure on M cross, on a G2 invariant, G2 structure on M cross S1, which therefore survives the projection. Now, in this is dual to type 2A, and some type 2A orientifold model, where the fixed point sets of tau are typically some special Lagrangian 3 cycles in M. Well, so real 3, as we've constructed, real 3 cycles in M. So you have orientifold planes, which orientifold 6 planes, which span R3, you know, R3-1, and this 3 cycle. And these are the the 6 brain charge has to cancel by putting in D6 brains if let's say I just have a single RP3 just to fix ideas, that has charge 4, so you need to put in 4 D6 brains, which gives you an SO4 gauge symmetry. Which is unbroken if the D6 brains sit on top of the orientifold plane. That is, wrap this RP3 and span R3-1, and is broken if you move them off. In the M theory language, this quotient here, as we've written it, has a pair of fixed points, okay, which are the form RP3 cross the points 0 and 1, okay, on the circle, and these are A1 singularities in the G2 manifold, sort of an SU2 cross SU2 symmetry, and smoothing The M theory compactification corresponds to moving the D6 brains off of the order interfold plane. So, what? I just gave RP3 as an example. You pick whatever the fixed point sets of tau are, and that's what it is, and you compute the number of D6 brains that you have to throw in, and you on this side you get some gauge theory. Well, in either picture you get some gauge theory, and you know there's a correspondence between the two dual descriptions of the story. I just gave RP3 as an example. Okay. So that's one dual situation. Another dual situation is if you have a K3 fibration, which usually comes equipped with a section, and then this is in turn dual to Hetherotic theory on a certain Calabi-Yau manifold M, which is a T3 fibration over the same base. Okay, so the idea is that in seven dimensions, M theory compactified on K3 is dual to Hetherotic on T3, and we imagine doing this at least over every smooth fiber. We imagine doing this fiber by fiber. Okay. Since Strominger, Yau, and Zaslow tell us that most Calabi-Yau manifolds have this T3 fibration structure, there are, for every one that does, there's always an M-theory dual, okay, obtained by this fiber-wise duality. So the point is, if you're in such a situation that depending on where you are in the moduli space, one description or the other will be more useful for doing computations. The fact that they're dual means, you know, that you're just, you know, you're describing exactly the same physics. It's just depending on where you are, one description may be more useful for actually doing computations. Now remember, in step two, we're supposed to end up someplace, right? Okay, we no longer have a moduli space of solutions. We end up with a bunch of discrete points. So if the discrete point where we end up is in the range of validity of one or the other of these descriptions, then we're happy because then we can do computations. Okay, but you should not forget about the existence of this and what any other dual descriptions, because before you figure out where you end up, you know, you don't know which description, if any, will be the useful one. Right? So you want to keep them all in mind until you figure out where you are. Okay. So, as I said before, X should not be taken to be smooth, because then we don't get very interesting physics in this M-theory description. And we've already seen an example of it having sort of ADE singularities over some 3-cycle. And in addition, it'll have further worse singularities in various other places. These yield non-abelian gauge groups in 4 dimensions. We said that we want to end up with that. And these ultimately field chiral matter. But it's more, we need more than that. X should not be simply connected. Okay, because we're going to have to make use of that. There'll be discrete of the three-form gauge field and I mean, I suppose one could sort of go on. So, you know, the ultimate question is, you know, can we find an X with all of the requisite properties that we need to enumerate? So, as a first step through this, we might study So we might study M theory on X tilde, which is the simply connected cover of X, and there these ADE type singularities will lead to simply laced gauge groups, like, say, this in physics is called the grand unified and I suppose E6 is another interesting grand unified group, but you'll get bored by the time I've talked about SU5 and SO10, and we won't want to go there. So the idea now is to consider Q tilde, which is a three-manifold of partially resolved, in the SU5 case, E6 singularities, and in the SO10 case, E7 singularities, and I bet you can guess what the E6 case is. Okay. And so you can describe the fibers in various ways. One way is to use a sort of hyper-Kähler quotient construction of the fibers, or for physicists, an N equals 2 quiver gauge theory. Okay, so if I draw, you know, a Dinkin diagram, you should think N equals 2 quiver gauge theory. And so in the SU5 case, as I said, let's see. Well, there's colored chalks. We can use colors. That's actually better. Let's find appropriate colors. Let's do it this way. Oh, beautiful. So that's the extended Dinkin diagram for E6. Okay, and so what you read off from the Dinkin indices, which I'll put in just to be friendly, you have a U1 cubed cross U2 cubed cross U3 modulo U1 diagonal. Gauge theory with hypermultiplets in bifundamental representations given by the links of this diagram. And the D terms for the white dots are all zero, and the D terms for these other guys, they have to add up to zero because, of course, the diagonal U1 is absent, so its D term has to vanish too. Okay, so those three guys add up to zero. And now, depending as you move about on Q, these D terms vary as you move about on Q, and some places one or the other of these things might vanish. Okay, might have some simple zeros, and when what do I call it? Red. The red guy equals zero, I get a massless 10 of SU5, or 10 bar, as I'll explain. And when this guy equals zero, I get a 5 bar or a 5. Okay. And now, to explain the chirality, you basically, that just depends on the sign of the determinant of dA of dDA dXB at d of x equals zero at one of the zeros. Okay. So if you think, imagine you have an isolated zero, right? You can the matrix of partial derivatives is non-degenerate. Take its determinant, take the sign of that, and that'll determine the chirality of the zero mode that's located there. Yes.
I must have missed a step. Did you say that there are sort of 7 manifolds x tilde known with these singularities, which gives you all this?
Ah, right. Okay. Compact? No. Okay. Non-compact. What?
There are no examples which are compact away from this.
Right. So, like I said, if I take the fiber literally to be given by C2 mod gamma, okay, then yes, I can construct such things. If I really want it to be a K3, okay, and not just a K3 with a local ADE singularity someplace, okay, then the answer is no, okay? That's life. Obviously, we want to find such guys. And so SO10, maybe I'll draw the picture for SO10. It's the same kind of deal. Well, I need all the different colors of chalk now. This is annoying. So let's see. What does it look like? Yellow. blue. What's left? Red. And the Dynkin indices are 1, 2, 3, 4, 3, 2, 1, 2, right? And so, what is it? D, blue, equal to 0 gives you a 16, and D, red, equal to 0 gives you a 10 of so 10. Okay. Right. So this is all now on the covering space, okay? And so we get one of these grand unified groups and matter in these familiar looking representations of the grand unified group. And now what you need to do is you yes?
You could have arranged this thing on a non-symmetric manifold by just taking Q to be a non-symmetric manifold. Is that bad for something?
Ah, well, then we're not there yet. I mean, we're about to do that. Arranging what about Q? This is the over a point in Q.
Right. If you just choose Q to be non-symmetric connected, then just vary this very easily. You're going to get a non-symmetric connected manifold.
Oh, well. Oh, well, okay. For the gauge theory stuff, I don't actually care that the fibers are compact. Okay? If I actually want gravity, if I want a finite M Planck in four dimensions, then I actually need that X is actually compact.
No, I'm not talking about compactness, I'm talking about fundamental. You wanted to get an X with an fundamental.
That comes next.
Universal
car. Well, whatever. I'm about to do that now, but I have to give you an ingredient, okay? That you know comes in the quotient, okay? So the point is, I don't want SU5 or SO10. It's not what I want. So that's a sort of convenience of thing. So now I take X, you know, to be you know quotient out by some finite group action, and and then what you end up doing, well, I mean, let's say, I don't know, just to fix ideas, maybe this is Zn, but that isn't really essential. The idea is now that what I need to do is pick a non-zero, non-zero periods for this three-form field, or expressed in a slightly more topological way, a class, a torsion class in for the corresponding field strength. Now, I should put, I don't know why I just put quotation marks around that. That whole thing is in quotation marks because it's supported along this singular locus, along the image of Q in X, okay? And it's actually easier to describe what's going on because, I mean, well, it's right. In terms of H2 of Q with there actually so what the physicists call this is a Wilson line, okay, in this SU5 or SO10 gauge group, which breaks that group to a semi-simple group, which is the the standard model. So breaks SU5. SO10 to this across an X for U1. Okay. Yeah. That's right. And then it is. This in the torus. This is sorry, which are you asking about, X or Q? Well, like I said, right, in physical language, these are Wilson lines on Q, right? So the heterotic dual, remember, is a T3 fibration over the same base, say, right? And that produces a gauge theory on Q, and I put Wilson lines in that gauge theory. An SU5 or SO10 gauge theory, and I have Wilson lines in that. They're Wilson lines of finite order, so it's an element. So in SU5, right, it's an element that looks like the holonomy, okay, is an element that looks like alpha, 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 alpha to the, what is it, n, it needs to, well, let me write it this way, with k chosen so that this is an SU5, okay, so that 3 plus 2k equals 0 mod n. Okay. Right. So. Right. Exactly. Okay. Sorry. Yes. Well, no. Sorry. No. This wasn't an isomorphism. This comes from a class in here. So when I describe this as periods of the C field, you usually think of elements in here, right? That's right. And you have a sphere cross a torsion one cycle in Q is a three cycle. Okay, and C has a period on that. Okay. Right. Okay. So it's a little awkward to describe. So if I just think about it in terms of H1 of Q with R mod Z coefficients, or, you know, I mean, in other words, what you'd call a Wilson line, you're probably happier. Right. So where were we? So now, in the picture I've just described, if gamma acts freely, maybe I should have put tildes on it to begin with. We sort of end up with a situation where these D terms are just the pullbacks via the covering map of the things on X. Okay, which leads to a certain awkwardness, namely. That if we're interested in the minimal standard model content from X, then, so that's the equivalent of three generations plus one, set of Higgses, then that means that on the covering space, you had three order of gamma tens, four order of gamma phi bars, and one order of gamma fives. Okay, these are all chiral. So D had lots of zeros upstairs and fewer zeros downstairs. Okay, and immediately, actually, this is somewhat awkward because it leads to something called the doublet-triplet splitting problem. Okay, and the problem can be stated succinctly if you look at 5 plus 5 bar and you decompose it under the standard model gauge group, the SU2 doublets are the Higgses that we want, okay, and which at this scale are massless. These extra guys are junk. They're color triplet junk, which, I mean, is disastrous, okay, and we need them to be very heavy, but these things are, in this computation, these guys are all degenerate in mass, and so you need to go through various Baroque mechanisms to try to get rid of the color triplets. And now, it's a little bit peculiar that that's the way things seem to work here, because in the heterotic theory, and remember, in the situations that I've been talking about, you very often have a heterotic dual, this really isn't a problem. Okay? And as near as I can, so the reason why it's not a problem, as you can show, is that in the heterotic situations, you often find examples where, so there, remember, we have, you know, M tilde and M is M tilde mod gamma, okay, where it might even be the same gamma, okay. There you might find a single gamma invariant 5 plus 5 bar to go along with the three order of gamma 5 bar plus tens. So, you know, the number of these guys is given by an index theorem, and the index divides, but there's no sort of index protecting the number of these guys. You might just have a single invariant guy which descends to the quotient straight on. And in that situation, there are there's no double triplet splitting problem because the triplets are projected out of the orbifold theory. Okay, I mean, I don't want to go through that, but it's true. Okay, and so you might want to do the same thing here. And actually, this is work in progress, but I think I know how to do it here. But it's a little bit more Baroque, and I can tell you that basically what it involves is at the conical singularity where these Higgses are produced, okay, gamma doesn't act freely at that point. Okay, So that's a fixed point of the gamma action. So that's why you can get just one set of 5 plus 5 bars on the covering space descending to one on the quotient. So it's a little bit more baroque than what's been done, but it's I think, in some sense, the natural thing to do rather than the more baroque mechanisms for trying to get rid of the color triplets. Well, okay, even if you've done that, the next difficulty that you find in this subject is proton decay. And the subject of this actually is vaguely reminiscent of what Dirac called his most embarrassing moment. Which in when he first proposed the Dirac equation and found that there were solutions which were electrons and holes, he thought that perhaps the proton was a hole, okay, because it's positively charged. And he decided that all theorists should apply their theories first to themselves. And since electrons and holes tend to annihilate rather rapidly, leaving nothing, he would have been gone long before he could have told anyone about his equation. And here too, if the proton decays very rapidly, we're gone long before, you know, we get to submit the paper to the archives. Okay, and there's a severe problem with proton decay in, you know, if I just sort of, I hate to say if I did a generic construction of this sort, because I don't even actually know of one, okay, but if I did the generic construction of this sort, I'd be in big, big trouble, okay? And the reason is the following. You know, what we want are super potential. So, in SU5 type theories, proton decay is the biggest problem. And in SO10 type theories, it will have troubles with neutrino masses. So anyways, what we need is that the superpotential should contain terms that look like which when the Higgs's eventually get, you know, VEVs down at the weak scale, give masses to the quarks and leptons, right? But what you don't want are terms like that, or and maybe also you'd like to forbid terms that look like that. So this has variates baryon number by one unit, and these guys vary it via light lepton number. You can actually probably get away with just forbidding these and having these be reasonably small, where reasonably small is, you know, 10 to the minus 2 or something like that, which, considering the fact that there are other coupling constants in the standard model which also have to be, you know, 10 to the minus 2, it's not that, this isn't that unreasonable. It actually might even be phenomenologically nice. But anyway, you certainly need to forbid these, and there are also some higher order terms in the superpotential that also need to be suppressed, if not forbidden entirely. That's in general hard. I mean, if you just, you know, randomly threw these things out and you tried to compute them, you'd probably get some answer, and it might be small, but it'd be hard to make it really small enough, because, like I said, we disappear very fast unless the coefficients of these terms are really, really tiny. So the best way you can do it is, best way. And that X has some so not things we intend quotienting by, but simply some automorphisms, okay, that which lift to actions on these guys of some sort. So for instance, the most example might be a Z2 under which H and H tilde are even, and the other guys are odd. And if you have such a Z2, then you can see the good terms are allowed and the bad terms are forbidden. This is related to something called R parity, but is actually hard to realize in any sort of example you might try to cook up. Certainly in the heterotic string theory, where people thought about these things for a long time, since, as I said, there aren't really any actual examples in the M-theory context. I mean, I don't know what's hard or easy. it's not an easy game to try to do. And it gets particularly tough if you try to make it compatible with the fluxes. Okay, because I wanted, in stage two of our three-stage process, we wanted to turn on fluxes. And if the fluxes aren't invariant under this discrete symmetry that we posit, then I will end up inducing terms which will violate the symmetry, and I go away. Okay, so it's quite a hard game to play. So one thing that you might try to do is go to SO10 type theories, where is it still up on the blackboard? Yes. Where where there's this extra U1, because I have this larger gauge invariance, some terms which might have been allowed in an SU5 type theory are actually forbidden by the gauge invariance of the SO10 type theory. And in fact, there's a symmetry under which baryons and leptons rotate with opposite phases, and this is just some linear combination of the two U1s in the gauge group. And so any term which is not invariant under that is forbidden by gauge invariance. Right? And all the dimension 4 things that we wrote down are thus, you don't even need to think about them. They're gone. The trouble, you still need to worry about dimension 5, but you're already much further ahead than you were before. The trouble in these theories turns out to be neutrino masses. And I think actually the trouble is so bad I'm almost going to tell you all to reject them and go away and not think about SO10 type theories anymore. Either that or go and figure out how to produce neutrino masses. The problem is the following. If you decompose the spinner of SO10 under SU5, just to fix it, as you know that a standard generation of quarks and leptons fit into the 5 bar plus 10 of SU5. And so there's one extra guy, okay, which is a singlet under the standard model gauge group, okay, but which carries, is charged under that U1 prime, okay? And his sort of called a sterile neutrino or some such nomenclature. And to be viable, you need to give this guy a fairly large mass, okay? And there are only there's sort of two known mechanisms for doing that. And when I say known mechanisms, this is, you know, back in field theory, long predating anyone thinking seriously about string theory, people thought about grand unified theories, and they said, here are things we can do to give this guy a large mass. And one is to imagine that there's a chiral multiplet in the imaginary self-dual five-index anti-symmetric tensor representation of SO10, okay? And then if that guy has an expectation, develops an expectation value, that gives a mass to this n, okay? And that does what you want. Okay? Unfortunately, I know of no way to produce such a beast out of string theory, M theory, any variant thereof, okay? And the other one is to break and then if you compute loop diagrams, it's a little bit weird. It's something that starts off its life as a term in the Kähler potential of the SO10 theory. But once you give expectation values to the field that breaks SO10 to SU5, it ends up being an effective superpotential term for n, okay? But it occurs at the two-loop level, so that means if you want to give m a decently high mass, you need to really have this happen at a high scale. But if we're going to do that, I mean, why did we even go through this exercise? I mean, we might as well have started in SU5. From the point of view of string theory, we might as well have started in SU5 with all its known problems. These, from a string theory point of view, this is not that much different from that thing. Really pretty darn close to the gut scale. I mean not, I forget exactly how high you need to push it, but pretty darn close. Because remember, like I said, it's a two-loop diagram that you write, okay? So, you know, you've got gauge couplings and 1 over 16 pi squareds, you know, all over the place, so it's you're kind of in trouble. I was going to say something, make a few comments about fluxes, but I think maybe I will instead end with neutrino masses and let everybody go to lunch, because I can tell they're hungry. Okay. Yes? Right. Would you sum over Wilson lines in the path integral? Why are they different? It, adding it doesn't change. Well, I claim the questions are isomorphic, maybe even equal. Well, it's everywhere. It's everywhere in four-dimensional space. So it's sort of a super selection sector. So the volume of four-dimensional space is, I mean, if we end up in Minkowski space. Not if you're in the sitter, but then again, there are lots of things we don't understand about the sitter. Even if we're in the sitter, it's a very, 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 very large the sitter. And so I'm not sure why I'm not justified in doing field theory, fixing the boundary conditions out at the Andromeda Nebula, right, and not worrying about summing over the values of Wilson lines out there. Right. Yeah. I mean, Greg is right. In the sitter space, there really aren't super selection sectors, but, you know, in the sitter space, who knows what there is? Okay. So I'm not going to worry about that. I'm really a Minkowski observer for my lifetime, anyways, and I have super selection sectors, and that's all I care about.
Mm-hmm.